Welcome to episode number 5 of our podcast series, The Paper Trail from the Netherlands Journal of Geosciences. My name is Henk Kombrink, and in my position as the editor-in-chief, I'm asking authors of papers published in our journal about the highlights of their research and also the driving forces behind performing the study. Just to make research papers more accessible and giving authors a platform to tell a bit more about what goes on behind the scenes of writing scientific papers. In this episode, I'm talking to Stefan Spiekman. Stefan is a paleontologist and works at the Natural History Museum in London as a postdoctoral researcher. He recently published a paper on the dental configuration of a jaw found in the Winterswijk quarry in the Netherlands. The title of the paper is "An Enigmatic Lower Jaw from the Lower Muschelkalk of Winterswijk Provides Insights into Dental Configuration, Tooth Replacement and Histology." Welcome, Stefan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Just as a starter of the conversation, I had a look at your Twitter profile recently just to familiarize myself a bit. And there it was, quite a prominent announcement that you are apparently linked to the royal family in the UK.
Yes, this is true. Around the same time that I published this paper, another paper of my work here in London also got published, which was actually on the oldest known meat-eating dinosaur of the UK. So this received quite a lot of press interest. So I also did some interviews for the BBC, which were broadcast. And apparently people thought that I looked like a good mix between Prince Harry and Prince William. So they made a meme about me, which, to my great surprise, and I thought it was pretty funny, got over 100,000 likes on the internet. So I decided to share that on Twitter. But now I'm very happy to talk about this paper, because actually, you know, the oldest meat-eating dinosaur from the UK gets a lot of attention. But I think actually this type of material, and also just the quarry at Winterswijk and the fossil material from the Netherlands, also deserves some attention. So
Of course. And let's not deviate too much to the royal family. So I think let's try to kind of put your paper into a bit of context and talk a bit about Winterswijk as a quarry, as a significant quarry for Dutch paleontology first. So how did Winterswijk kind of look like in Triassic times?
So first of all, I think, my research focuses on reptile evolution. And In the context of reptile evolution, the period, the fossils we find in Winterswijk are from a very, very interesting period, the Middle Triassic, because it is really in the Triassic that reptiles were evolving in all kinds of new forms. So basically the first members of all the modern lineages of reptiles were first evolving. So the first turtles, the first lizards, and the first members of the lineage leading to crocodiles and dinosaurs and birds, they all started evolving during the Triassic. And actually some of the most interesting developments were actually in the oceans, where you had the early ancestors of what would be the plesiosaur, so the animal on which the Loch Ness Monster is based, and other marine reptiles. They were all evolving during this time. So it's really, it was an evolutionary radiation going on during this time. And that is what makes this time period specifically interesting. Mm-hmm. And in Winterswijk is an area that was part of what we call the Muschelkalk. So the sediments we find there are Muschelkalk sediments. And the Muschelkalk are basically the deposits that were placed within what we call the Germanic Basin. And this was basically a very shallow sea that was connected to the larger sea in an area that includes the Netherlands, Germany, and also parts of Poland. And Winterswijk was positioned at the very western edge of this sea. And it was actually quite interesting depositionally, because it was very shallow. So we actually find layers of Winterswijk being completely flooded. And then also when it was like an intertidal system. So actually a little bit like the modern day Waddenzee.
Right. So it was, and it was a lot warmer, I guess, a subtropical climate as well, wasn't it?
Yes, I mean the world was a lot warmer at that time generally, and yeah, it's often described as subtropical, yeah, and quite arid. But obviously, this was the sea.
Yes. And you were saying that it was a really important time for the evolution of these reptiles. And that has everything to do with the fact that a few million years earlier, you had the Permian-Triassic extinction, wasn't it? Where, yeah, lots of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So this is the largest mass extinction event in the history of life. So prior to the this extinction that we often just call the PT extinction, or, as a cooler name, it's often called the Great Dying, because it is, the largest mass extinction event of all time. So it was actually much, much deadlier than the one that killed off the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. I think around 97 or 98% of all species in the oceans went extinct. So this is, was really incredible. And prior to this time period, when you talk about the large vertebrates, the large animals that we often consider as dominating the world. So before this mass extinction, you actually had ancestors of us, of mammals. They were called the synapsids, that were mainly the dominant group. And in the oceans, you had all kinds of fish. And after this extinction, almost everything went extinct. And this actually allowed new animal groups that had previously been not as diverse to evolve and occupy these spaces. So you really have to look at it in the same way. Many people know the story about the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs went extinct 66 million years ago, at least all dinosaurs except the birds, because birds are actually a lineage of dinosaurs. But anyway, all these dinosaurs, they went extinct. And then after this extinction, this is when the mammals became very diverse and radiated and took up all these evolutionary niches, these ecological roles. And this is exactly what happened in the Triassic, but basically on an even larger scale. So this is when the reptiles started to dominate. These synapsids went into decline, and these reptiles became very dominant. And actually, this whole time period is called the Age of Reptiles, the Mesozoic. But the interesting part is that in the Triassic, later on in the Jurassic and Cretaceous, everybody knows the dinosaurs were dominant. So in my mind, this is a bit, it's a bit boring. We all know these dinosaurs, they were big, they were scary, but, they were all dinosaurs. Whereas in the Triassic, you had tons of different reptiles that were all radiating, all doing different things. And this is why the Triassic is so interesting to me as a reptile paleontologist, and also why, you find mysterious and interesting things like the jaw we described.
I see. Are you saying that the diversity in terms of different reptiles that were evolving at the time is even more diverse than what you see later on in the Mesozoic when you've got the dinosaurs, or is that too easy to say?
It depends on how you measure diversity, right? If you look at diversity in terms of number of species, then don't really, because you were still in the period of recovery, basically, after this mass extinction event. There was still, you come from a very low, and then you're climbing up to normal levels, basically. So it was still a period of recovery.
Yeah.
But you had many different lineages. So in a way, they were all, much more diverse in terms of how many different clades of reptiles were around and all the things they were doing. So yeah. It depends on how you measure these things.
Of course. So focusing a bit on what you actually report on in the paper, and I think it was your co-author, Nicole Klein, who actually found this bit of what happened to be a jaw, didn't she?
It got discovered in a joint excavation by Naturalis in Leiden and the University of Bonn, where Nicole is affiliated. And this was a student expedition. I'm not quite sure who exactly discovered the specimen, but this was in 2011. And basically the material that was discovered all went to Bonn for preparation and study. And this is how Nicole got to work on this material. I actually also have joined on these excavations a couple of times myself. But this was much later. So this specimen was actually found before my time, and then eventually I got to work on it, which was quite cool.
And how did this kind of evolve the project as such? Because obviously you were not involved when it was found. So how did you get involved in the end?
Yeah, that's actually quite an interesting story, because Nicole, you know, who is an expert on these animals, she looked at this jaw, and for a very long time she didn't know what it was, because it doesn't look like anything else we know from Vincent Dyke. And because it's only a jaw, sometimes it's quite hard to say what it is. You know, is it even a fish? Is it an amphibian? Is it a reptile? So she thought it could be a member of a reptile lineage that is actually quite, that is, you know, stereotypically one of those weird thoracic forms, which are called tenestrophids. And this is actually the group I did my PhD research on in Switzerland. So basically Nicole came to me and said, like, is this thing a tenestrophid? And I looked at it, and pretty quickly I could tell that it wasn't a tenestrophid, but I didn't know what else it could be. And basically this is how I got involved with the project. And then me and Nicole, you know, decided to investigate more to figure out what it was.
I see. Yeah, no, that's a clear link then. So what made you conclude that it wasn't a jaw of this particular species she thought it was?
I had just been working on actually a lot of CT data, so CT scans of the skulls of these animals that I did my PhD on. So I had actually a very nice 3D model of how the jaw looks with the teeth inside of it, and just looking at the details, both the form of the jaw itself, as well as the shape of the teeth, didn't really follow that of the animal I studied.
Yeah. So what happened then? So you concluded it wasn't that. What was your kind of line of attack to find out what it was instead?
Well, so it was a side project for both me and Nicole. So it basically, yeah, the project went in leaps and then large gaps, basically, because we both had other projects that we should also focus our attention on. But basically, it was a lot of emailing colleagues. So luckily, you know, as a paleontologist, I have some friends who are specialists on fish. I have some friends who are specialists on these big amphibians that were around at the time, Themispondyls. These are big predatory amphibians that you had in the Triassic. And so we basically asked all of them what it might be. And nobody really knew. So we just couldn't figure it out. And then Nicole, who's an histologist, meaning someone who looks at bone tissue. That's if you're a bone histologist, which is what she is, you look at bone tissue specifically. She decided to take some sections of the specimen, so make a cross-section of the specimen and basically look at the tissue inside, both of the teeth and of the bone, to see whether that could give us more insight. And actually, we really needed this histology to determine that indeed it is a reptile, and that it's most likely a member of the lineage that's called Sauropterygia. So this is the group that includes animals like the plesiosaurus, the Loch Ness monster.
So you acquired these, was it kind of CT scanning you did, or what type of kind of analysis did you do?
Yeah, so in order to try and figure out what this thing was, we basically threw everything we had at it, which was taking these sections and CT scanning it. So we did both, and the CT scan gave us some additional data. But the main thing that really helped us determine what this animal was the histology, the thin sections, because then we could basically compare it to the literature and see in the literature how things like tooth replacement, a tooth implantation, so how does a tooth connect to the jaw, how this works in this animal. And this is quite specific, you know, this is quite specific between different reptile groups, and as well, it's also different between reptiles and amphibians, reptiles and fish, et cetera, et cetera. So this was really the information that helped us solidify our, you know, diagnosis.
Right. And can you, based on the analysis you did, et cetera, can you maybe describe in layman's terms how this animal looked like when it was alive and kicking there in the Winterswijk area?
Yeah, so we only have this one jaw. Mm-hmm. So it's not much to go by. But this group of reptiles that it belongs to, the Sauropterygians, as I said, they are relatives of the plesiosaur, which is this long-necked marine reptile with flippers. But in the Triassic, they were actually quite different. And the ones we think this animal was most closely related would have been the pistosaurs or the nothosaurs. These are two different groups within this larger group of Sauropterygia. And the nothosaurs are actually quite common in the Triassic all over the world. Well, not all over the world, but in many places. And this was an animal, it was a marine reptile. It was a hunter, so it has these large, that's also what our jaw shows, it has these large curved fangs almost. And they would have, you know, interlocked. So the one from the upper jaw and the lower jaw, they would have interlocked with each other to call what we call a fish trap almost. Which you can also see in some modern day sharks. Yeah. And yeah. It would still have had a long neck, but not as long as a plesiosaur's neck, and it probably would not have had flippers yet. So it would have mainly used its body sideways movements of its body to swim, and it would have probably been restricted to coastal areas. So quite a cool and a bizarre animal, and I definitely recommend everybody who's never heard of them to just Google a nothosaur and see how these animals look like.
Yes. And this was really the first find of this particular species in the Winterswijk quarry, wasn't it?
Yes, it was completely new to Winterswijk. But over the course of us doing the research, and also when we did the histology and we figured out it was a reptile, we figured out, actually Nicole figured out, that there are some other jaws, the jaw fragments, that are known from Poland. So in Poland, there are actually localities that are almost of the same age as in Winterswijk. And these are actually the oldest known Muschelkalk deposits. So this is at the very, very beginning of this inland sea, at least when the reptiles were around.
Yeah.
And there were two jaw fragments, actually of the upper jaw. So the part we have is the lower jaw, but there are two parts of an upper jaw that actually have very similar teeth to our specimen. So we think that it's very, very likely that this is the same species or a very closely related species to the one from Poland. And the species in Poland actually has a name because it was named very long time ago, close to 100 years ago, I think. And it's called Lamprosauroides guberti. So it's a very complicated name. But so basically what we then decided on is we said, okay, this is a totally new animal for Winterswijk. And it looks an awful lot like this thing called Lamprosauroides guberti. But first of all, Lamprosauroides guberti was named a very long time ago, and it's only known from a single upper jawbone. Nowadays, most people would probably not assign a new species based on this small piece, just because it doesn't contain enough information to really comfortably say, oh, this is a species, we can diagnose it, we can differentiate it from everything else. So what we did is we said it looks an awful lot like Lamprosauroides guberti, and then you put a CF in front of it, so you say this animal is closely related to or looks like Lamprosauroides guberti.
Ah, I see. That's what the CF stands for.
Yeah.
So is there, you think, potential to do follow-up work in order to find more remains of this particular species to firm up more evidence as to how it looked like, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, we need more material. The thing is that the Muschelkalk, a lot of material is known from the Muschelkalk, but most of it comes in the form of individual bones, bits and pieces. And obviously, when you now find a vertebra, you know, a single vertebra, then it's very hard to say, oh, is this the same species as this lower jaw?
Yeah.
As long as you have nothing overlapping, it's very hard to assign this. So what we probably need in order to really say this with certainty is, more complete specimens, which they do occur in the Muschelkalk. Articulated specimens. So hopefully now we will start finding more, because also now there is a very active community of local collectors in the quarry in Winterswijk, and I am in contact with them as well, and I shared the paper with them, and their initial reaction was, okay, great, there's something new in Winterswijk, now we can keep our eyes open for more of this stuff.
It's interesting what you say about you often find just individual bones and not on a kind of an intact skeleton. Mm-hmm. Has that something to do with how the deep position environment was, where it was too energetic to kind of preserve the whole thing in one piece?
Yes, most likely it does. I'm not... this is the first time that the second time I've worked on Muschelkalk material, but it's not been the main focus of my research, and I'm not entirely sure of the depositional setting there. I just know that the Muschelkalk is mainly known for isolated bones. But yeah, it could mean that. It could also mean that that there were a lot of bottom feeders, so that things did not have the time to settle and become preserved as a whole. But if there's a lot of bottom feeders, then everything gets scavenged and everything falls apart, and only then does it get fossilized. So it can have multiple reasons. Not quite sure exactly what for the Muschelkalk generally is the reason that we mainly find individual bones.
But that makes a lot of sense actually. If an animal is just lying there, of course it would have been eaten.
Yeah, so this is actually, so my research in for my PhD, which was in Switzerland, in Zurich, the fossils they have there is from a very famous mountain called Monte San Giorgio. It's actually a UNESCO World Heritage Site for the amazing Triassic fossils people found there. And it is very similar to the Muschelkalk, both in space and in time and the type of animals you find there, but it's quite different. And in Monte San Giorgio, I know, for instance, that the bottom, the seafloor at that time was anoxic. So basically there was very little oxygen there. So there were basically no scavengers on the seafloor. So if anything would die higher up in the water column or somewhere else and would just be floated in, and then it would sink to the ground, it'd sink to the bottom at Monte San Giorgio, there would be no, crustaceans or mollusks or other invertebrates or vertebrates that were feeding on these carcasses. So they actually are a lot more complete. So that is what I know from Winterswijk. I'm not quite sure what the Muschelkalk, the situation was there, but also the Muschelkalk is a very large area and how the situation was in Winterswijk could be different from how it was in Poland, for instance.
Of course. As far as I know, the Muschelkalk, I don't think it was an anoxic type of area. So in that sense, it's maybe a bit more likely that scavengers were on the hunt mm-hmm. in that area at the time. So is this something you are currently still involved in, or is this kind of something that has now finished and waiting for someone else to pick up? Potentially,
I'm still involved with research at Winterswijk because it's one of the main. It is the main Triassic site in the Netherlands. I'm always trying to be very involved with that, and I think it's a very interesting quarry. I hope to go there again this summer for fieldwork again. It hasn't been possible in the past 2 years, in part because of COVID, but this year I hope to be there again. And I've also recently been involved with a bachelor student who did a project on material from Winterswijk at the University of Utrecht. So I'm still definitely involved in Winterswijk research. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Stefan, for taking out your time today to talk about the project and your paper. I think it was really informative. So thanks again. This was episode number 5 of The Paper Trail. Thank you for listening and hope to hear you next time. Thanks very much. Thanks again, Stefan.
Very welcome. Thanks for having me.